Great, thanks very much. Okay, so I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you a bit of background to the hadronic vacuum polarization contribution to the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, and then I'll show you results mainly from our work in the HPQCD collaboration, but I'll compare to other results as we go along. Okay, so I mean, the message is, I think, that we're making quite a lot of progress on this, you know, as a community, so this is all good. So I'm working with Bipasha Chakraborty, Gordon Donald, Rachel Dowdall, Jan Kopone, and Peter Lepage, and we're using the U.K. STFC Dirac facility that we now have in the U.K., fantastic facility, which we're hoping will continue beyond next year. The specific element of that that we're using is the cluster in Cambridge called Darwin. Here's a picture of it in fancy blue light. That's just to set the scale for the kind of computing we're using, which is not massive. So the muon anomalous magnetic moment, this is related, mu, to the muon spin by this factor g here. And the thing that we're interested in is the so-called anomaly in g, i.e., the difference of g from 2 divided by 2. This actually is measured, can be measured directly, this anomaly can be measured directly in experiment, and it can be measured to incredible accuracy. So what you do is you put polarized muons into a ring that has electric and magnetic fields in, but there's a special momentum where the terms that depend on the electric field cancel, and so you get a simple relationship between a difference of frequencies. This is the difference between the spin precession and the cyclotron frequency with which the thing is rotating in the ring. This frequency can be measured directly. You get the direction of the spin from the decay of the muons. The decay products are thrown out in a direction which is correlated with the spin. But at this specific momentum, you can relate this frequency that you measure directly. I mean, it's a difference of frequencies, but you can measure this frequency, this difference of frequencies directly, and it's related to the magnetic field and the anomaly. So it's not that you've got to subtract anything from 2, you just measure this. So this was done at Brookhaven very successfully, and this result was obtained. And the whole thing has now been shipped to Fermilab to improve the experiment. It's now called E989, and starting in 2017, this 6.3 here will be reduced eventually down to 1.6. So that's a factor of 4 improvement in the experimental uncertainty. So that will be very exciting to see how this central value shifts or not. And then the question is, how does this compare to what you expect theoretically, and in particular, what you expect in the Standard Model? So the anomaly comes about from interaction of the muon here. The muon is a straight line, so the muon is interacting with a photon to give you this magnetic moment relation, and then all sorts of virtual particles go around here, and this is the thing which gives you an answer which is different for g from 2. This is a picture I stole from review by Tom Bloom. The diagrams which dominate here are the ones in QED, so with these wiggly photons attached all over the place. Incredibly impressive calculation has been done in QED for this to very high order in perturbation theory. There are also electroweak corrections here. You can see W's and Z's, for example. They've also been calculated in perturbation theory. The electroweak piece turns out to be very small, in fact. But those two pieces are very well known. Then you've got the pieces in which QCD plays a role, which is where Lattice QCD comes in. And these are the diagrams along the bottom here. The dominant one is this diagram here. So this is a quark antiquark loop with all sorts of QCD stuff going on in this hatched area. This is the so-called leading order hadronic vacuum polarization contribution, in which you've got one quark bubble here attached to these photons, which are attached to the muon line here. And then there are higher order pieces here, which are considered to be so-called part of the higher order hadronic vacuum polarization, because they, for example, have lepton loops or extra photons attached to them. And then this is the so-called hadronic light-by-light piece, which is more complicated. This is the largest contribution, however, and in fact the one which currently dominates the theoretical uncertainty on this anomalous magnetic moment. So it's the one I'm going to be talking about, how we can do lattice QCD calculations to help pin down the theoretical contribution for this. It's a good idea to have, to start with, an idea of where we're, the number we're heading towards here. So what I've done here is to take the experimental value for the anomalous magnetic moment and subtract these well-known QED and electroweak pieces. And then you get an answer which is 722 times 10 to the minus 10. So you can see this is just the experimental uncertainty here, because the theoretical uncertainties in these two pieces are tiny. Now this... Sorry, here. Yes, so this is the hadronic light by light that Tom will talk about tomorrow. Sorry, you can... Yes.
Another photon in the hadron is the same order as that, so you have to have electromagnetic corrections there, right?
Sorry, a photon
in that hadronic loop.
In that hadronic loop, yes. So you could imagine having a photon coming out of there and coming back in there. Now that is something that we have to address. Yeah. Yeah. So, subtracting the very well-known theoretical pieces from the experiment, we get 722 with this error of 6 here, which, as I say, comes entirely from the experiment at this point. That answer, then, is the leading order hadronic vacuum polarization contribution, which I'll just call HVP. The higher order hadronic vacuum polarization pieces, which are diagrams like this, and the light by light, plus, of course, any new physics that isn't in. Yes. Yeah, basically.
Yeah, so those
now, it turns out that the higher order hadronic vacuum polarization piece, as currently determined, and this piece as currently determined, basically almost cancel. So if this piece is zero, i.e. there is no new physics, what we are expecting to get for the hadronic vacuum polarization piece, this diagram, is pretty much the same, 721 with an error of 7. So the error's gone up here a bit because of the uncertainties in these two pieces, currently, as currently stated. So bear that number in mind, because that's sort of what we're comparing to the whole time. So what is the current situation, the best method at the moment to extract this quantity theoretically is using experimental data, particularly the E plus E minus to hadrons cross-section. So use dispersion relations in the optical theorem to relate this contribution to this cross-section integrated over the center of mass energy multiplied by this factor K, which has 1 over s pieces in it, so this integral is pushed towards small center of mass energy, so it's the low energy piece of the E plus E minus cross section that dominates this. So this cross-section that goes in here is a so-called bare cross-section. You have to take out some factors of effectively the photon vacuum polarization to put this together. So there is some messing about with the data that has to be done. But this does include final state radiation, so effectively it includes photons in this loop here. This is the current status of these calculations. So remember this number here, this is the no new physics number. And there are a number of theoretical determinations of this. Of course, they're all using the same data, or at least, you know, most of the same data, because the data does improve with time. So, you know, things are changing slightly. But essentially, the same data is being used here for these determinations. Now, people tend to quote this number from Hagiwara et al, this orange one here. That's 695 with an error of 4. That's somehow the standard number that gets quoted. But in fact, you know, there is a bit of tension between the different numbers here, which is worth bearing in mind, I think, from our perspective. The older, so there's some older numbers here. So there's a paper by De Veer et al, in which they derived a result from the plus E minus cross section. There's also, you can also use tau weak decays. But the difference between these two is, of course, this is a W decaying to hadrons. And so to actually effectively convert that back to the kind of hadronic distribution you want for this, you do have to pay some attention to issues. For example, rho photon mixing. So there was some difference between these results back in this paper that was then sorted out by Jaegerlainer and Saffron by introducing a more sophisticated effective theory of rho photon coupling, etc. And they claim in this paper that the E plus E minus and the tau results are now consistent with each other. There is then another subsequent paper by Benayoun et al, which includes Jaegerlainer, in which they also derive a result from E plus E minus and tau analyses combined. Meanwhile, there's this analysis from Hagiwara, which includes only the E plus E minus data. So these numbers are actually sort of consistent in pairs, but if you look at the red one and the orange one, they differ by 15. They're both quoting an uncertainty of around 4 or 5. They differ by 15. This is 681, and this is 690. Yeah. Well, the main difference between these two is actually not that there is a tau analysis included here, because that, in fact, doesn't make any difference. The difference is that these people do not include the Babar radiative return data in the whole set of data that they look at for E plus E minus. So the radiative return data use initial state radiation in order to move the center of mass energy around effectively. And there's quite a lot of tension in that data, Babar data with Chloe data, for example. So Benayoun et al. Drop the Babar radiative return data, whereas Hagiwara et al. Include it. Yes. Yeah, yes. So the point is that the Babar data have quite a lot of weight in the total of radiative return data, and they, you know, effectively cause this difference whether you include them or you don't include them. Now, you can decide, as Benayoun et al. Did, that they're not consistent with the other data, or you can decide that they are consistent, in which case they basically give you the answer for the radiative return piece. So that makes a difference of 15, as I say, which is actually, you know, quite a lot on the scale of the uncertainties here. Of course, it's, you know, this is actually further from the standard model. So at some level, this is not, you know, I think Hagiwara et al, for example, I talked to Thomas Teubner about this, they're quite relaxed about this Benayoun number because it's actually further away. So it's not that the message is any different, but it certainly surprised me anyway that the results using basically the same experimental data, except slightly changing the sets included or not, could make as much difference as this when they're quoting an uncertainty of this.
So
So we just have to bear that in mind, is all I'm saying. I'm not criticizing them because I wouldn't know where.
I think it's fair to say that most people consider betting to be fairly aggressive.
Aggressive in dropping the VABAR data. I mean, you have freedom, though, right, to drop experimental data.
Probably more conservative estimates. And the other interesting point is that there's going to be new data coming out for the Chinese experiment.
Yes, from Bess.
It should help to resolve this difference between Chloe and the one.
Yes. No, so that will be good to see. I mean, I think even the data kind of exists, but they just haven't been analyzed yet, isn't that? That's true. Okay, so even better. Yeah. Yeah, so that will, at the very least, it will reduce the VABAR weight in the total of radiative return data and may actually, you know, effectively resolve this.
Christine, what, you, kind of what you're assuming for the errors in the hadronic light by light in order to put that?
So I'm taking numbers from. Recent review, did I actually take them from here? I'm not sure, but there's this so-called Glasgow consensus for the hadronic light by light. So that's basically the number that I'm including. This comes from a meeting that Dominic. Yeah, so this is why this uncertainty goes up, because this uncertainty is quite substantial on a small number, but compared to the experiment, I mean, I've just added everything in quadrature here.
How large is the number you said? It's like by
light 10? It's about 10 in units of 10 to the minus 10, yeah. And this is about minus 10. So I think this is, yeah, they do basically cancel. I mean, just, you know, coincidentally. This is negative, and this is positive.
The first one is HPV.
Well, this is what I'm trying to extract here, right? What do we believe this number is based on all the other numbers and the experiment if there is no new physics? So, yeah, 720. But I mean, the difference between 700 and 720 is significant. You know, if it was actually 700, we wouldn't be having this discussion. So, yes, yeah, yes. Right, let's go on to lattice, shall we?
I said light by light is only 2 sigma.
It is relatively uncertain. It's just believed to be small and therefore actually not a big. No, no, absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, look, that's what Tom's going to talk about tomorrow, so let's not.
You go back to the plot on the two comments.
This plot.
The discussion sort of sloughed over. So I think the first point is that the E plus E minus and tau data is not in such a rosy shape that new information with completely different systematics is unwelcome.
That's why we're doing this calculation, yep.
And the second thing is that light by light might be very uncertain in itself, but since it is 10 on the scale of a discrepancy of about 30, it would have to be really, really, really,
well,
really wrong.
25, but yeah. Yes. Yes. But it could, I mean, there are certainly people who believe it's really, really, really wrong, yeah. Yes. Yes. However, there were.
I think there's sometimes people say, why don't you just focus all of your brain power and resources on light by light and don't worry about vacuum polarization.
Yes.
I think this graph nicely brings out that vacuum polarization is worth the while.
Yes.
The main difference is that light by light is mostly theoretical uncertain because there is no direct data, right? It's compared with, of course, it's much smaller than.
Let's not get sidetracked on that because we're going to talk about it tomorrow. So,
people
scientists are fond of saying, you have to do this or you have to do that. And I'm saying there are settings of the knob somewhere between the two extremes, which is the right place to be.
I'm telling you about the hadronic vacuum polarization because that's what I have results on. I don't have anything to say about light by light. So if you want to, yeah. So Tom, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Right, let's go on to lattice calculation of hadronic vacuum polarization. So we're calculating this hadronic bubble here. It's quark loop with all sorts of QCD stuff going on in there. Now, Tom set this whole thing in motion 13 years ago. What you have to do is actually evaluate this integral. So you're now working in Euclidean Q squared. You have the this vacuum polarization bubble as a function of Q squared here. Now, it gets multiplied by various factors. These alphas are alpha QED. This E is a charge for the flavor of quark that is in this bubble. So I think it's important, you know, coming back to what Andrea said, you know, this is a different calculation from this one, and it has pros and cons. One of the pros is that we can separate out the different flavor contributions writing the bubble like this. This is the purely connected bubble. We'll come back to the disconnected piece later on. But each of these contributions for each flavor are separate in this, so we can evaluate each of them separately. And of course, that's not totally possible here. I mean, there are places where you can separate it, but this cross section is just a cross section. You integrate over it. You don't necessarily know where the hadrons came from. So this is the integral we have to do. There's this kernel function f of q squared, which is, I've plotted here just to sketch it out, as this red line here. It diverges as q squared goes to zero, and it is the scale for the q squared variation in this function is the mass of the muon going around here. So this is plotted, this red curve is plotted as a function of q squared in units of the mass of the muon squared, which is tiny. Remember, the mass of the muon is 0.1 GeV. Now, what goes here is this renormalized vacuum polarization function, pi of q squared minus pi of zero. So it actually rises up from the origin steeply as a function of q squared, and when you multiply these two things together, you get an integrand that rises and then falls. And what I've done here, just to give you an idea of what this integrand looks like, is I've just put in a pi hat of q squared for a meson in this bubble, so just a meson line across here with various masses in. So for a rho, you know, you get something like this. For a phi, you get something like this. For j psi, this orange curve down here, you get something much flatter at the bottom here. So you can see all of these integrals. I mean, the kind of thing you're expecting is that it's dominated by the small q squared region, and by small q squared we mean, you know, with set by the mass of the muon, and then you've got this this tail going away to higher q squared. Now, what we actually want to do is calculate this for the real case where you've got a quark bubble here with QCD stuff going. So as a function of q squared, can't remember, but yes, I mean, it is going to be included in your calculation. The photon goes to pi pi pieces. I mean, I haven't put it in here, but you could make such a plot. The pi pi piece is important, yes. We'll come back to that. Well, you've already done the manipulations that go into this. You're saying why?
Why? What is bounded or saying? The description is the rule of thumb. What is what?
This is the bit that goes in here. Yeah. Yes, effectively.
Yeah.
included in the notation.
I think Jarvis is in the paper by the way.
Right. So coming back to this, so to determine this pi hat of q squared, where this is a vector current here because this is a photon, you can work with just. So what I'm going to show you is our method, which works simply with a correlator made of spatial vector currents at zero spatial momentum. So the quantity that you are looking at on the lattice is just a correlator that is has a vector current at two ends. And as I say, we're using a spatial vector current at zero spatial momentum. So this is exactly the correlator that you would make to look at vector mesons. But of course, it contains all sorts of stuff inside there. The vector mesons are the things that dominate at large times in this correlator. But at shorter times, you will have excited vector mesons and all sorts of stuff, you know, including perturbative QCD stuff. But if you take this correlator that you would calculate on the lattice and you normalize it to the continuum, so there's a normalization factor here, ZV, that I've allowed for. If you take time moments of this correlator, which simply means multiplying by power of the time, starting at zero and going both positive and negative time around the lattice to the halfway point, you can relate this moment to the q squared derivatives of the vacuum polarization. So you end up with an expansion of pi hat of q squared in powers of q squared. So because we've subtracted the zero, the value at q squared equals zero, this just has a leading term, which is q squared times pi 1, then q to the fourth, pi 2, and so on. These coefficients are related to these moments simply by this expression. So the coefficients are the different moments divided by factorial, and they alternate in sign. So the first one is plus, then minus, and so on. So what we're going to do is just actually take our vector correlators, take these time moments, calculate these coefficients from them. That gives us an expansion of this powers of q squared. And then we're going to, in fact, convert that into, we're going to use Padé approximants instead of that Taylor expansion, and then just perform this integral here. Yes, that is so. You know, other approaches include calculating this thing as a function of q squared, and then you have to worry about. I mean, you have to worry about all the same issues, right? What is the q squared shape, and so on. It is that you have the. So you know, we could do time moments, but we are actually only working at zero spatial momentum. So. You know, we're just using correlators that we already have. Yeah, and, you know, so you could do that, and it would be very equivalent to what we're doing.
But why is it an advantage not to do that? That's the direct momentum space object.
The thing you want is the expansion of this around q squared equals zero. So people have tried, you know, the problem people have had is actually getting close to q squared of zero. So what we do is actually just expand about q squared of zero.
Fine. So why don't you just use that fact? I don't see why you would then make a polynomial, which is then a crazy function in Q. Sure. But then you go to
No, but if you want to Yeah.
I think it's just a
I think it's a different way of phrasing it, but
you have to compare the different methods.
Yep.
I don't think there's a clear advantage in the outside of one or the other. You just have to compare them.
Well, there's a terribly divergent series.
No, because the point is that it's the small q squared region that you're actually after here. So, you know, and tiny, tiny q squareds we're talking about.
When you're standing up and say each term, you can take this expansion, each term is a trivial option, right? Yeah. So each term by itself doesn't make sense for integration. So in this way, you are firstly kind of should sum up to see that expansion of q squared it decreases, not increases, right?
Well, it's doing this, yeah.
But there, then I'm not sure if you are using, real, kind of curve of experiment. And the question is always about the error. The bulk of the data is okay, but the bulk of the data to get an answer, it's enough to put an over, and that's enough.
So that's why we've done loads of tests of this method, right? We have done loads of tests of this method. Lots of tests, many tests of this method,
many
tests of this method to show it working for integrals that are the kind of integrals.
No, but you are not showing the picture of
she has not
yet.
Sorry, let her explain what she's doing.
Not right, but who because if you are not introducing the spectrum, why you believe it makes sense?
Of course, it makes sense to do this. The question is just the uncertainties and how well you control them, right? So if you look in our paper on this, so we started out looking at the strange quark contribution, and I do want to get on to the results, actually. So let's... So this is the method. We use Padé approximants, and then the question you have to worry about is the stability of the Padé approximants and how accurate they are, the convergence, and so on. So we did lots of tests of this method, looking at different Padé approximates, looking at artificial data with different amounts of noise in to see how, as you go from very inaccurate data to very accurate data, you can push up the level of your Padé approximate. We actually used the 2-2 approximate, but we compare results from 1-1, 1-2, and 2-2. To see the convergence. So this, I believe, people can try this on their data, but I believe that this is a very solid procedure. I mean, indeed, the problems with doing this calculation are not anything to do with this, I think. So we compute 4, 6, 8, and 10, typically. The fourth moment here, so that's J equals 1. So it's the fourth moment in time. That is the critical one that gives you the first coefficient. And that is the main contributor to the answer. Well, effectively, that is embedded in the Padé approximate, right? Effectively, it is in there, right? Just from the form of the Padé approximant. We can discuss that later. Let's not get bogged down in that here. But that is one of the roles of the Padé approximants is to control the large Q squared behavior. Yes. Well, I'm going to show you all of this, right? I'm going to show you some results. So just hang on, and I'll get to the results. Because, yes, one of the points I'm trying to make here is that actually we have to do this for up, down, strange, sharp, and bottom. Sorry? Yes, so you have to watch out for that the poles don't go into some silly place, right? That is the thing with Padé approximates. So there are these numerical tests. I don't know off the top of my head, but we test that they don't move off into the complex plane. Let me show you some results. So for the charm contribution, this is the J psi. one of the things that we did, and we did this quite some time ago, not actually imagining using it for G minus 2 at that point, is we calculated the moments of the vector Charmonium correlator. So this is the one that gives you the jape psi at large distance. And of course, this our time moments method was developed for pseudoscalar correlators to extract the charm mass. But looking at the jape psi, the vector, of course, we had all the information that we needed to calculate the vector moments. And these are, and these can be, in fact, directly extracted from experiments. So people like Hans Kuhn and company actually determine from E plus E minus goes to hadrons the region that, I mean, by using perturbation theory and the data, they're able to extract the bit of E plus E minus goes to hadrons that comes from a charm loop. So this is one place where you can look at a specific flavor contribution from the experiment. And these are these black points here. And the blue lines show our results for the 4th, 6th, 8th, and 10th moments, so the ones that we use for G minus 2, as a function of lattice spacing squared here. So we're using a range of different lattice spacings. We use our highly improved staggered quark formalism. And this is working on milk configurations that include up, down, and strange in the sea. And so you can see here very nice agreement between the experimental moments and the results from lattice QCD. So it tells you that that charm bubble agrees. Sorry, do you mean charm? Are you saying charm? Yeah. Yes, there's all sorts of continuum results for charm. I'm just showing here how the lattice results agree well with the moments that you would extract from experiments. So it's you can then just use these results to get the charm quark contribution to the hadronic vacuum polarization. And it's about 14 times 10 to the minus 10. It's no surprise that this then agrees with what you would extract in the continuum for the same quantity, because the moments directly agree. It's largely coming from the renormalization ZV of the current, because one reason we use the pseudoscalar is because that's absolutely normalized in the Hisk formalism. The vector isn't, so we have to determine renormalization. So we're using perturbation theory for that, yeah. Because the conserved current's a lot more complicated. This is using a local vector current in the staggered formalism. So it's much easier. It's point split. The conserved current is point split. So, I mean, it's partly laziness, but it's partly simplicity. It's
so the point split, just the mutual point split term, I don't think it's that noisy.
No.
But it's just one the mic term.
Well, it makes everything harder to do, right?
Should you take these local currents and bring them together in no contact?
That's you, the time moment gets rid of that for you, right? There are no contact terms in this expression.
But I think quark, it's like in tonal shape, right? Because nobody kind of much of doubt about contribution for C-quark or pay.
No, but what we're showing here is that the lattice reproduces that very accurately, right?
It's not, I can't say, it's a tonal shape for lattice calculation rather than something else, because this uncertainty would be more or less the same.
Yes. I'm not claiming that we have a better uncertainty here. I'm just claiming that this is part of a consistent lattice calculation of all the flavor pieces. Now, charm is actually quite difficult to do on the lattice. The highly improved staggered quark action is fantastic for this. So that's why we can do this calculation. But it's difficult typically in lattice calculations when you don't have such a good action. Okay, but, and also we've done the bottom contribution. Now, of course, that turns out to be completely tiny, but we did this with NRQCD recently as part of a program looking at upsilon, particularly the leptonic width of the upsilon and the upsilon prime. And again, we looked at these moments and we renormalized the current in the same way as for the charm case, and you find the B quark contribution to the hadronic vacuum polarization is 0.3 times 10 to the minus 10. No, this uses the same method as we used here, in which we use the high-order continuum QCD perturbation theory to fix it. And so couldn't resist showing you this plot just for 5 seconds so you could admire it. I mean, this is then the whole big picture of decay constants, because, of course, you know, what comes out of these kind of calculations are decay constants for the ground states and excited states, as well as these moments that contribute to G minus 2. So you can put the whole thing together and get this nice picture of the decay constants for different mesons in their value order. So coming on to the strange quark contribution, that is the thing that you know, we set out to do here, from Hisk strange quark propagators on the milk. So this is now looking at the milk, the new milk, 2+1+1 configurations that include highly improved staggered quarks in the C, the SEA, up down with the same mass, strange and charm, and include range of lattice spacings, a range of light quark masses going down to physical light quark masses. So what we did here was again use the local vector current, so the local S bar current, and we renormalized it with a non-perturbative method, so we used the form factor relation for the vector. To do that with staggered quarks, you have to put a clover quark as a spectator, because you have to have a non-staggered quark as a spectator in that case. So this, in fact, whole program came out of my attempts to prove that Andreas was wrong about his matching for clover staggered heavy light currents. So you can see how far doing something like that can take you. But anyway, so we looked at basically two sets of light quark masses here, the physical ones, which are these red points, and then ones in which the light quark mass is a fifth of the strange, that's these blue points. You can see there's not much difference between them. Each of them had three different lattice spacings. We had three different volumes at an intermediate light quark mass. So these are the results for A-mu on each of these configurations. The errors are correlated here because they're largely coming, in fact, from the determination of the lattice spacing for which we use this Wilson flow parameter W0. So what we got from this was a strange quark contribution to the anomalous magnetic moment of 53.4 with an error of 6. So that's about a 1% error, which is, you know, what we're trying to get to here. I mean, that's a ballpark that we're trying to get to for the whole thing. So this was a demonstration that this was possible for the strange quark contribution anyway. And we were able... Actually, I'll come to that in a second. We were able to compare that to some kind of continuum determination. Thomas Teubner did that for us. So this is just a simple fit in A and in C quark masses, because, you know, very small discretization errors here and very little dependence on the light quark mass. Sort of coming back to what I was saying earlier, that we can look at the ground states, which are the phi mesons in this S-bar correlator, ignoring disconnected pieces, which, you know, are there at some level but expected to be very, very small for the phi. We can compare our results to experimental values for the decay constant of the phi coming from its leptonic decay rate and its mass. So all of that looks very nice. And since we did that calculation, there are some results from the Twisted Mass Collaboration, European Twisted Mass Collaboration, and this year from RBC UK QCD, Andreas Jutner sent me some plots of these recently. So this shows very nice agreement everywhere, as far as I can see. These red points, I mean, for the twisted mass calculation, it's actually very difficult to, you know, you can't actually extract the strange quark contribution from their paper. So they had to separately then, I think it's to do with the way their strange quark masses are tuned, they had to separately go away and extract the strange quark contribution from their results. And these are the red points here for the strange quark contribution. And their final result is 53 with an error of 3 from doing this, which agrees with ours. It seems to have very, very steep discretization errors in it, but I think that's some feature of the way they do their calculation. Don't quite understand why their discretization errors are so big on that. This is just the connected piece.
But there is a mixing the current, which is change the stage to go to non-stage.
We'll come to the disconnected piece in a minute. But what all that we're doing here is comparing different lattice calculations for the same quantity. So this is a apples and apples comparison for the connected strange loop.
The current doesn't keep current to be strange and strange, right? Because the current does mix with the other current.
This is simply a strange loop. That's what we're calculating, right? A photon and a strange loop.
No, I understand. Not right, but I mean that there is a contribution which is a
that is the disconnected piece. So this is a well-defined quantity in lattice QCD. You can argue about the comparison to experiment.
We should draw disconnected diagrams, define our language.
Sorry, I'm going to come to the disconnected. So the disconnected piece has, you know, two hadronic bubbles connected by gluons. And this is a photon, right?
And we call this disconnected because all the gluons
are
small.
No, we have to include it, right? But we are not including it here, and we're not including it anywhere here, so we can make this comparison. And it's a reasonable it's important comparison to make, right, from different lattice QCD methods. So these are the RBC UK QCD results on the right here, and this orangey band is their initial extrapolation, which you know, agrees fine with our result up here, which I've just marked on top in a little black arrows. Now, as I say, we were also able, Thomas Teubner, just by looking at the cross-section and basically picking modes out of the cross-section, you can get a reasonable continuum estimate for the strange piece. Modulo issues with connected and disconnected diagrams, but from their work, they estimated a value of about 55 from the continuum. So, you know, this is all hanging together pretty reasonably. So there are no issues with bottom, charm, or strange, really, in the comparison between the determination from E plus E minus and the lattice determination. So that's useful information. Yeah? Well, from the ETMC thing, this is the extrapolation uncertainty, I assume, because they're doing such a big extrapolation. RBC is still working on this, RBC UK QCD, so they're not quoting a final number yet, so we'll see. Let's come on to the light contribution. So this, when I'm, so far, the results that I'll show you will be all from taking the up and down quarks have the same mass. And so what we've done is a similar calculation to the strange calculation using the Milk 2 plus 1 plus 1 Hiss configurations with the light quark mass set to the light quark mass in the C. We've used the same ZVs from the strange calculation. We've got the same multiple lattice spacings, multiple light quark masses, including the physical point, multiple volumes at a specific light quark mass. So for this analysis, we've included the M light of a 10th M strange configurations, but we have not done the fine. So we've got very coarse, what we call very coarse, coarse and fine configurations. We have not included the fine physical point because that's very expensive to do. So we calculate vector correlators just the same way. And the problem here, of course, is that they're much, much noisier. As you go to lighter quarks, you pick up a lot more noise in the correlator. So what we've done to reduce the variance is that we've included fit information and not just calculated the moments from the data, which is what we did in the other cases. So we just take the moments from the data out to a certain value of t star, and then beyond that point the data is actually worse than the fit, and so instead we take moments from the fit. And you can play around with the value for t star, and we don't see much effect from that. At the moment we're using a t star of 1.5 Fermis, which corresponds in units of the mass of the rho to 6/m rho. So this means that the bulk of the result is coming directly from the data, but the remaining 30% is coming from the fit, which is, which uses short t information to decide the large t behavior. Now, again, as you go down from heavier to lighter quarks, you get more and more of the contribution from the ground state, because the ground state saturates the correlator at earlier times. And so in this light case, in fact, 80% of the result comes from the rho pole. And so this does mean that you've really got to understand your rho very well on the lattice. Don't think we're there yet. And there will be finite volume effects in that coming from its pi-pi decay channel. There's also 10% contribution coming from direct pi-pi pieces. This is very sensitive to finite volume effects and to the mass of the pion. So for staggered quarks, because we have at a given lattice spacing, we have a set of pions of different tastes, a set of different taste pions that have different masses. The masses differ by amounts that depend on the lattice spacing and vanish in the continuum limit. But at the finite lattice spacing that we're at, we have separated pion masses. And so we have to take this into account when we're thinking about the pi-pi contribution. It's the majority, so you'll see. I'm going to do the arithmetic at the end. Yeah, so, you know, everything else is light. It's 600. It's 600 of the 700. Sorry?
What have we seen so far? About 10 at the bottom, about 20 at the top, about 50 for strange.
It's nothing for bottom. I will do all the arithmetic at the end, so just hang on. And you'll see. Yeah, it is the majority of the contribution. It's the majority of the contribution. If you look in the E plus E minus goes to hadrons, 520 of the whole thing comes from the rho meson pole, right?
So
yeah, the pi pi contribution is 70. Yeah. We do various numbers of exponentials using this Bayesian analysis. So typically 4, 5, or 6. You know, again, you can change it, right? And it doesn't change things once you've got a decent fit. So I'm not going to show you the final result because we're still working our way through some of the issues here. One of the things that we've done, which I'll show you, is to see, you know, effectively what is the largest we could get for this piece, and therefore what would be the largest hadronic vacuum polarization value that we could see as being reasonable, because, you know, it's all about, are you less than or more than 720, right? So one thing we've done is actually to pay attention to this dominance of the result from the rho meson pole. And so if you think there's anything wrong with your lattice rho, you can rescale the rho piece, effectively rescale the coefficients of your expansion to replace your lattice values with the experimental values. That means first you've got to subtract off the pi pi piece, and you can do that with staggered quark, effectively staggered quark chiral perturbation theory. And then you add them back on again at the end, you add back on the continuum pi pi piece. And you, so this, what you're left with then is really completely dominated by the rho, and you can rescale the moments. since you know how they depend on F rho and M rho, where F rho is the decay constant.
This is, may I comment at this point? The equation C is shown does not work for a plus and minus to be plus and minus. So this procedure has no theoretical justification.
I'm not doing anything very clever here. I'm just subtracting off the pi piece and rescaling the rho piece. So, I mean, I don't... All I'm doing here is...
Oh, I understand what you're doing, but I am saying that the real pi mass in the real rho, but you can check that kind of integration theory is wrong. It doesn't work just from experimental data. So in this way...
There are all sorts of issues about... low energy cross sections that.
Very small mass of pi, it doesn't grow in the real world.
We'll park that for the moment, shall we? Because I'm just going to tell you what we've done. And what I was about to say was that the main issue. So this is elaborating on a method that the twisted mass people introduced, in which they just rescaled their correlators by. The rho mass, we're sort of taking that very seriously and rescaling the whole thing by the experimental parameters of the rho. The problem here is that actually it turns out you don't know what they are. You know the mass, of course, but you really cannot extract the decay constant with any degree of certainty because of the width of the rho, basically. So the extraction of F rho is very dependent on how you handle the width of the row, either looking at... No, the experimental value. I'll show you the lattice results in a minute, but the experimental value for F row, you would think, well, let me just take the leptonic width of the neutral row. That, you've got to be very careful what you do with the width in that formula. You think, well, okay, let me use tau decay to rho charged, mu tau. Again, how do you handle the width in that formula? And these, depending on what you do, F rho changes by 10 MeV out of 10. So, I mean, I'm talking about 5% here, but of course, that's actually a huge issue here because it turns into a 10%.
Why don't we escape by rho? By only escape?
So you don't have to put the F rho in here. The twisted mass people didn't. I'm just saying that we did that as a. I'm going to show you a comparison of results. No, I'm not saying it's better. What I'm saying was if you thought you didn't understand your row very well, you might imagine just replacing your lattice row with the experimental parameters. But you can't really do that because actually the experimental situation for the row is not very good in terms of matrix element, determining QCD matrix elements like F row. Well, you didn't, yeah, so it's fine. I've mentioned how the pi-pi contribution is distorted because of the staggering. So it's important, actually, not to work just at the physical point, but to have other masses in there, which we do. So I'll show you some results for that. And you do have to pay attention to finite volume pieces, that the pi-pi piece is also distorted by finite volume effects. So actually, you do need a 7 Fermi lattice at the physical point to get... this 1% accuracy in pi pi, if you don't have the staggering problem. We have the staggering problem on top of that. In the same way that we looked at the phi physical properties, we can also look at the rho. What I've done here is actually compare our results. So these are the red results on very coarse cores and fine lattices for the mass and the decay constant of the rho. Twisted mass people provide a nice table in their paper with these parameters for their calculation. So I've just done a direct comparison. So you can see how m rho against the square of the pion mass, how it differs in the two sets of data. M rho is the mass of the rho meson. It's just the large time mass in your correlator. Well, eventually the rho would decay to pi pi, but in our correlators it doesn't, of course, typically. Because it's a p-wave decay and you need momentums on a finite box, it doesn't typically. Although, in principle, the pi pi mass is below the rho mass on our... Yes, and the coupling is incredibly weak. So, yes. Nobody has actually seen the pi-pi as the, you know, long time mass coming out of their correlators as yet. I mean, we tried to force our correlators to give us pi-pi, but they didn't. Sorry? Yes, yes, but not in this calculation. I mean, it's one of the issues that you have to sort out here, is what I'm... these are all important points about the row. I mean, what I'm just trying to show here is that... we are in reasonable shape against experiment here, but our m rho is slightly low and our f rho is slightly low as well at the physical point. For the twisted mass data, the masses are higher. I mean, they're at higher pion masses as well, but the rho mass is quite a lot higher, and so is the decay constant. They're on smaller volumes typically. As is Hisk, yes. Obviously, the ETMC data is twisted mass. Yep. It's 5.8 fermis. Yes. That is true for. But it isn't in our correlators for the time lengths that we have. We tried to force the fit to give us that, and it just put the amplitude to zero. So, I mean, you know, within our uncertainties, right, which are quite high at the physical point, you know, the statistical errors are quite high at that point.
So, you just can't find it?
Yes.
You said that, I think you said that you did a fit with a free parameter for the rho mass and another exponential with the energy equaling
what we estimated, e pi, yeah. Yeah, yes, and it didn't want it. So, I mean, or at least, you know, it just chooses to put the amplitude very, very small and effectively zero. So, this is a... Yes. Yes. Let me just show you where we are with this analysis, because I want to say something about disconnected pieces. This is on the top line here is doing this rescaling. So what we've done for this is to rescale with the physical rho mass and take the decay constant of the rho to be 217 MeV, sorry, 0.217 GeV. That, if you do that, because you've effectively... taken out this chiral behavior that you have here, this behavior with the light quark mass, you get a beautifully flat curve. Actually, everything does just collapse onto this single curve, and you can see that all the different light quark masses are consistent with each other. You still fit this as a function of the light quark mass, but, you know, there's very little dependence here. The gray band here, this is the totally uncorrected data. So this is just the raw data, doing our method, calculated moments, doing the Paddy approximates, doing the integral. And this is, as everybody else has found, very strongly dependent on the light quark mass. We're going down to lighter light quark masses than other people, but, you know, this strong dependence is typical of people's results. So
this is a pure lattice result?
This is a pure lattice result, yeah. And we've got different volumes here. That's the three different points here. We've got very large ensembles for some of the points here. And these are the two physical point lattices. So this is, we reckon, the biggest number we could get. That's what I'm going with for the rest of the results I'll show you, just adding stuff together. This number's much higher, but it doesn't include the pi-pi piece correctly, for example. So this is definitely too low. You might argue that this is too high because, you know, the decay constant of the rho, as I say. This is probably an upper limit to the decay constant of the rho. But what we're trying to do at the moment is improve our understanding of the systematics here by looking at effective theories that couple rho and pi pi.
How much is dynamic equation theory that can be built to collection?
Sorry, how much? For
the
continuum pi pi piece is 70 at the physical point. So that we have to take out the staggered thing and then put back the 70. So that provides about half of this discrepancy here, because at the same time we're rescaling. Well, that's why you need a better effective theory, right? I mean, you know, this is why people like Jaeger-Lehner have...
When you're doing this collection based on the Kyle-Trevich theory, if you follow this Kyle-Trevich theory, then you can start from a pi-small. You can pi-small, then the minimum mu would be 1 over pi-square.
Yes, it diverges as the pi-mass goes to 0. Yeah.
It would be a dominant contribution.
It's 70. It's 70 at the physical point. That contribution.
No, that's wrong. That's wrong. It's 1 over pi squared is a known condition.
Yes.
Know,
yeah. You can calculate this.
So then, then you can find out that in reality, of course, it's not the dominant one, and it's a kind of factor like 40. So correction would be m pi squared divided by n squared. But it is m pi squared divided by n squared multiplied by coefficient 40. So in this way, it's not a dominant conclusion. However, what I'm trying to say is that it means technically that physical pi is too big to be considered 1 pi square as a dominant contribution. And when you're doing Kyle-Trevich equation theory, you're doing exactly this. You're considered 1 pi square.
Well, you can add higher order terms in if you want, but that's the dominant one. It's the one. It is the dominant one for the pi pi contribution. We can disagree about that later.
In this case, it's a power expansion. You see, it's more pronounced. It's not over by 1 over
pi. I think the issue is if you think of Kyle perturbation theory as an expansion around m pi equals 0.
We're not thinking of it like that. This is just scalar QED that we're using.
We're using a pion with a mass of 140 MeV, and you're putting it into a loop and coupling it to electromagnetism.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Right.
It's just scalar QED at this stage. You know, we're going to embed it in. Yes, it's, sorry, I'm just...
contribution of a point-like scalar meson with mass 140 MeV, and then all the other masses were the staggered taste. Subtract that from the lattice amplitude, do this funny scaling, and then add it back in.
Okay, but yeah. then you are saying it's not a kind of operation theory?
Okay.
I am saying that for what Christine is doing, I think that calling it Kyle perturbation theory is not a necessary use of language.
Yes.
No, but
there are simpler to think of it as scalar QED.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, but then it's not a Kyle perturbation theory.
Okay.
Why do we have to argue about
Yeah, let's not argue about terminology because you.
Based on smaller pi square.
Yeah.
And it's not my invention.
Arcadia, we all know that, but in practice, practice for what is happening here.
Okay.
We're arguing about semantics. And
yes.
I'm saying the parametric statement doesn't work in this way.
Yeah, I don't think anyone disagrees with you put that way. But yep. You object to saying, I have some lattice data. I use scalar QED to subtract out one contribution, and then try to use some ideas to massage the row contribution and add that back in at the end with scalar QED.
But
you
object to that.
That's fine. I'm saying don't call.
We're in agreement, right? We're in agreement. So let's not. No, can we tell me after? Tell me after, because I want to talk about disconnected pieces.
Yeah. But
yes. We can discuss it afterwards, right? I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying. So sorry if my language was confusing. So let me talk about the disconnected piece, because the disconnected piece is important. It's this diagram I drew on the board here with two loops that are quark line disconnected, so they're just connected by gluon pieces here. This vanishes in the m up equals m down equals m strange limit, so we believe it to be small. It vanishes just because the charges add up to zero. If you look at the different pieces for real masses, then actually it turns out so you put in up, down and strange, but you're calling the up and down, you're calling them both light quarks. Turns out that what you've actually got to calculate is the correlator for a light minus strange current at these two ends here. So you're correlating the disconnected pieces of light minus strange with a charge of 1/3. So if you think about it like that, just as a calculation of that disconnected correlator, then it has a charge 1/5 that of the total connected piece for light that you would calculate. So, you know, it's suppressed by this charge factor as well. What people have done has to be focused on these stochastic methods where you calculate all-to-all propagators and then trace over them for the two disconnected ends. And particular Vera Gulpers from Mainz has been working on getting cancellation of the noise by, you know, focusing on the fact that it's L minus S at the two ends. This is our result using her approach, and you can see that you do reduce the noise by correlating the light and strange random wall sources, but we still don't get a signal even after we've done a lot of sources. So we've got a bit fed up with this. Instead, the Hadron Spectrum collaboration do have very nice results for disconnected vector contributions. So we're working with them to see what the contribution to the anomalous magnetic moment would be. What I've done here is plotted their disconnected contribution for the different pieces. Light, strange, strange. So they have, you know, the light disconnected piece, the strange, strange disconnected piece, and the off diagonal light, strange. So obviously, to do light minus strange at the two ends, you've got to do light plus strange, strange minus two light, strange. And what I've done here is to normalize their disconnected piece to their connected piece. Now, because they don't have any Z factors or anything, so that normalization gets rid of any Z factors. What they're actually doing here is not a stochastic method, but you know, they have this distillation method in which you make a huge number of sources, 160 or something, that are eigenvectors of the Laplacian operator on that time slice. And it is, I think, simply, you know, the fact that they've got so many sources that enables them to get a signal without any of the noise issues that you have with stochastic methods. So what you can see from this plot when you actually normalize the disconnected against the connected is that indeed it is very small. The light piece, not surprisingly, is the biggest. This piece, so all of them start off positive at very small times, and then they become negative and they fall like this. So the fact that the light is falling down like this is a sign that the omega, which includes the light disconnected piece, has a bigger mass than the rho, so that the difference between the omega and the rho is positive. The strange piece is the red piece here, that's really quite small, and then the light strange is somewhere in between, right? So that's not really very surprising. But when you put the combination together, you get this black curve, which is really pretty small, and then becomes dominated by the light piece, apparently out at these larger times, but of course, you know, the noise is growing here. This is on anisotropic lattices, so they have very small spacing in the time direction, and it's a relatively heavy pion mass, although they do have a lighter pion mass now. If you actually go through our procedure for this case, then you find a contribution of the disconnected, the total disconnected piece from this of -1%. So really quite small. So you fit the whole disconnected 2x2 matrix to a set of states, and then I'm playing around with this at the moment, right? So I'm not claiming that this is the final answer, but I think it's going to be around -1%. Then you have to decide which bits of that fit to use. It's dominated by the light light. So, you know, you fit the omega and the phi and so on, and you just take the moments. So you take so it's the same thing, right? You take moments out to some point T star.
No.
Sorry. I'm using exactly the same method. Yeah. So you fit it. You take moments from the data out to some T star, which is around 40.
Moments of the whole black curve.
Yeah. In practice, you have to use fit. Well, about
30
in this region. Yeah.
And then you use the
yeah. Okay. Yes. It's some kind of smeared vector current, yeah.
How can you normalize it?
You have a connected correlator to normalize it against. But, I mean, obviously there are going to be issues with the fact that you've really smeared out the current. So one of the things that we will do is look at different amounts of smearing just to see how much difference that makes. I mean, yeah, so it is not, you know, your local current, which is what you would be trying to do in this approach. No. These are smeared at both ends. Effectively, you know, by their distillation procedure. You have to have some discretization of the vector current, yeah. And I'm saying that this is a smeared one, which is not ideal. But if you look at different amounts of smearing, we will probably find, but I could be wrong, that it doesn't make it, you know, it's going to make some difference down here at small time, but I don't believe that it will make a difference overall. I will tell you when we've done it, but...
it's a different wave function, it's an overlap. You want the correlator of the current. This is not a... you're not making it a wave function.
You want the correlator of some discretization as a vector current.
You eventually want the correlator of the vector current.
You can define the vector current in a whole load of different ways. Yeah, so when you...
So
go towards the continuum limit, you have to be careful with what you're doing.
No, I think crucially the size of the smearing has to go to zero with the lattice.
It has to be fixed in lattice units, yeah.
If it was a one Fermi object, then after taking the continuum limit, this would not be
true.
The current part of it.
Yes.
Yes.
You have to adjust the smearing as you take the continuum. That's
yes.
The correct way to
we are not at that point yet, but I. What I'm showing you here is something that gives you a number, right? We have no number except this number from chiral perturbation theory that's minus a tenth of the disconnected, and I'm telling you it's a hundredth, right? If you actually thought the disconnected piece was minus a tenth, then you would really, I mean, people say this, and then actually they don't do anything with that minus one tenth. So, you know, we actually do have to know what the disconnected piece is, and minus one tenth is not the right answer. Cannot be the right answer. So we need a better estimate than that, and so far there haven't been any. So, I'm telling you from this calculation, which is a long way from the continuum. I'm going to give you a continuum argument in a second. It's about minus 1%. So here's a very simple-minded continuum argument in which you just say the whole thing is dominated by the light-light piece, which it, taking the light-light piece is presumably conservative because the light-strange piece actually cancels off a large part of it. So if you think about just the light-light piece and you argue that that is the thing that's controlling the difference, physical difference between the rho meson and the omega, then you can derive a result for the ratio of the disconnected to the connected. So again, looking at what percentage of the connected is the disconnected, that is this simple formula. Now you then hit the problem that we just discussed, in which actually the decay constants of the omega and the rho are not well determined, because even though the omega is narrow, its leptonic width is actually not easy to get because of mixing with the rho, for example, mixing with the phi and so on. So this is actually quite inaccurate. However, by inaccurate, I mean at the 5% level, so you can certainly put in something with 5% uncertainties for this. And this simple argument gives you around 1.5%, minus 1.5%, with 100% error. So I think this is the kind of ballpark number we should be thinking about for the disconnected piece. And then we should be including it in our results. The omega mixes with the phi, yes, by a very small amount, but that is actually, as far as the leptonic rate is concerned, that's quite important. So you can't just work back from the leptonic rate. Yeah, but that doesn't affect the decay, you know, doesn't affect the matrix element so much as the rate, I think. So here's the arithmetic that we were coming to for our calculation. On the left, I give you the pieces for the twisted mass calculation. So that, I'm giving you the largest value I think we could get. So from this curve, this is 662 up here, but I think, you know, it will actually be smaller in the end. Strange and charm and bottom are well determined. We know what those are now. And then here's the maximum estimate for the disconnected that I can get, which is essentially taking minus 3% here and then adding minus 1/10 of the pi-pi piece. So using the chiral perturbation theory, minus 1/10, but only for the pi-pi piece. And that gives you something like minus 25, you know, which actually is important on the scale of these things. And that would then give a total of, a maximum total, I think, of around 705, an error of 20. Now, the twisted mass people get a final result from everything in their paper of 674, with an error of about 30. But their light piece is actually much smaller. So somehow between here and here, there's 100. And yet, you know, they actually agree with this and this. So I don't, I mean, you know, they add everything together and fit it, and then they separate the pieces, and somehow those two procedures don't commute. So it's not quite clear whether we disagree, you know, to what extent we're disagreeing or agreeing. I mean, in the end, we agree perfectly well. So this is our sort of preliminary largest number. We'll come down a bit. This is the twisted mass result here. These are the E plus E minus results here. And this is the no new physics scenario here at 721. So, you know, everything's certainly lining up here reasonably. We, on the lattice, we're not able yet to distinguish no new physics from possible new physics scenario. But we are getting there. All of this uncertainty comes from the up-down piece plus the disconnected piece. And we have to reduce that. We've also got to worry, you know, at a reasonable level, as far as this uncertainty is concerned, with QED and M up not equal to M down effects, which, you know, could well be at the 1% level. And, you know, the continuum people have worried about this as well, so we can get some estimates from continuum calculations of those. I, looking just in the literature a bit, I see numbers that are about 1% and positive for both of these effects, I think. So that's it. Yeah. Thank you.
We have time for one short question that also has a short answer. And if you have a long question with a long answer, it has to be done privately. Okay.
I'm planning to formulate when this about the carbon. I'm planning to just write that it's not immunology because carbon is used as a justification of the seizure. And I'm saying that there is no justification of the seizure, having in mind that in real world, this chiral deprivation theory for real mass of MPI doesn't work. You still can subtract and add what you said, but it doesn't mean that it's correct.
Okay.
It's not a question.
I didn't
hear it. You should look at the explicit formula.
These extrapolations are very simple ones. What he's complaining about is our pi-pi procedure.
Particularly, we have a massless propagator, which is what you would often do when you're thinking chiral perturbation theory. You've got some particle going along and it radiates a massless ion and absorbs it. That's not what you did.
No. But you need to embed the whole thing in a bigger effective theory, such as these people's, and that's what we're.
All right, let's thank Christine.